You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A group of dignitaries arrived at the White House today to greet President-elect George Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair. But the group, which included winners of the Nobel Prize and a bishop of the president's own Methodist church, did not have a chance to meet with Bush. They were arrested instead. Tom Gomez was there and filed this report.
The distinguished group that assembled in front of the White House today could have been received by the president at another time. Instead, today, the group, which included two winners of the Nobel Peace Prize, the Catholic Bishop of Detroit and the United Methodist Bishop of Chicago, were arrested when they climbed the fence that surrounded Lafayette Park in protest of the U.S.-led war in Iraq. In addition to the bishops, about 50 protesters, including ministers, nuns, and a rabbi, were joined by leaders from 20 human rights organizations and churches. Peace activist Mariade Corrigan McGuire was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1976 for her work to resolve the civil war that raged for generations in Northern Ireland. Today, McGuire and fellow Nobel Peace Prize winner Jody Williams of Vermont, honored in 1997 for her work to rid the world of landmines, spoke before being arrested in protest to U.S. aggression in Iraq.
We are here to proclaim that we, the people of the world, are not powerless. We have a power. And from our power, we proclaim to those in the world today who would destroy us with militarism and war and violence and cruelty. We are uniting now as the people of the world to say, we want peace.
We want peace.
My name is Jody Williams. Along with my colleague Liz Bernstein, we received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1997. The media bears some responsibility. From September to February of this year, on the three major networks, when 414 stories dealt with Iraq, only 34 of 414 stories did not originate from the War Department. We are here to show with our physical bodies that we oppose this if our words cannot be heard on television and in the newspapers of America. We're bringing democracy to Iraq when we don't even live it here.
Catholic Bishop Thomas J. Gumbleton of Detroit, United Methodist Bishop C. Joseph Sprague of Chicago, and former State Department analyst Daniel Ellsberg were also arrested in front of the White House when they climbed the fence as well.
I am Thomas Gumbleton, a Roman Catholic bishop from Detroit. I make a special plea to the young people in our military who I believe have been lied into going to war against the people of Iraq. I ask them to look deeply into their conscience. I ask them to look into their conscience and refuse to fight in this war. It is wrong. It is sinful. It is killing. It is against the law of God, which is very simply proclaimed, thou shalt not kill.
Over 500 clergy and prominent laymen have signed on to a statement calling on U.S. troops to refuse orders to fight in Iraq.
This is the image of the war that shames us. Shame on you, Mr. Bush.
Shame on you, Mr. Bush.
If, as one supporter of the president said earlier, the United States was created by God, guts, and guns, it is becoming increasingly clear that God has left the building. For Peace Watch, this is Tom Gomez from WBIX Refugees and Exiles Internet Radio Network, reporting for Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, D.C.
Signs at any given protests against the U.S. invasion of Iraq are likely to read "No Blood for Oil." It's a reference to perceived links between the Bush administration's family oil business and some of the world's largest oil reserves nestled in the heart of Iraq. Those supporting the invasion dismiss such claims as ridiculous and far-fetched, while those opposed to the war believe it's an obvious link. It's elementary. Jim Vallette is the author of Crude Vision, How Oil Interests Obscured U.S. Government Focus on Chemical Weapons Use by Saddam Hussein. Vallette says he's uncovered new evidence that oil has long been the driving concern behind U.S.-Iraqi relations. Vallette says through research of memos, telegrams, and documents dating back to the Reagan administration, he discovered plans for the Bechtel Corporation to build an oil pipeline through Jordan.
And from those documents, I followed up with further investigation into the records of the National Archives, which is the government institution, and in the old files of an independent counsel investigation, I found a whole bunch of documents, corporate documents from Bechtel and related pipeline promoters that reveal the degree to which there was an incredible revolving door between Bechtel and the White House, the Reagan White House. This revolving door inspired a policy to placate Saddam's concerns about possible attack by Israel on that pipeline project. This effort to placate Saddam took place between 1983 and 1985. And these documents show blow by blow how first Bechtel met with State Department officials in late 1983. Then Donald Rumsfeld flew to Baghdad and met with Saddam and talked about the pipeline. And that's where Saddam raised these concerns about possible attack by Israel. The memoranda show that the U.S. was quite aware that Saddam was using weapons of mass destruction against Iranian revolutionaries, against whom they were. Iraq was in a very bloody war at that time. These are the same weapons of mass destruction that the Bush-Cheney administration considers to, at least publicly, they claim this is the cause for war. And yet, in the 80s, these same weapons for mass destruction were, in their own words, in the words of these State Department officials, only a potential embarrassment to the building U.S.-Iraqi business relations. And it goes on and on. Bechtel and the Reagan administration and pipeline promoters employed some fairly dubious means of trying to assuage Saddam's concerns. They hired a Swiss billionaire who was close friends with the Israeli Prime Minister, Shimon Peres, and a related agent who flew to Israel and made a secret deal with Shimon Peres to funnel some of the oil pipeline profits into the Labor Party's coffers in exchange for a guarantee that Israel would not attack the pipeline.
And so you're saying they basically looked the other way when you say that they placated and assuaged Saddam's concerns. What were his concerns, and what exactly did they do to try to placate him, in your words?
Right. Well, in that meeting in December 1983, Donald Rumsfeld discussed the pipeline with Saddam, and Saddam said, well, we're worried, it sounds like a good plan, but we're worried that because it will flow so close to Israel, it'll be vulnerable to Israeli attack. This was around the same time that Israel had attacked a nuclear reactor in Iraq. So there was a certain level of conflict and remains certainly a very tense, to say the least, relationship between Israel and Iraq. So that was the origin of his concerns. And in his memo back to George Shultz, Rumsfeld put in a note that maybe this is something we should perhaps discuss with Israel in the future. That is Saddam's concerns about the Israeli threat. Rumsfeld flew to Jordan and met with King Hussein, and King Hussein said, "Yeah, we're all for this project. We just need to get Israel to guarantee that it will not attack the pipeline."
So what is the status of the pipeline now?
Well, it after 2 years of a lot of many flights between Washington and Baghdad and Israel and Amman, Jordan, after 2 years of very dubious efforts by quasi-officials and officials of the Reagan administration, Saddam rejected this scheme, or rejected the pipeline, in December of 1985, so 2 years after he met with Rumsfeld. It seems like the main reason was that he believed that Bechtel was overcharging for this pipeline. Bechtel claimed it would be about a billion-dollar project, and Saddam believed it to be about a $500 million project. At the same time, he had set up pipeline deals in Turkey and in Saudi Arabia. So
So that sort of left the U.S. out in the cold, basically.
Yeah, and it left Bechtel steaming. Steaming at, say, at Robert McFarlane, the National Security Advisor, steaming at some bureaucrats in the White House who didn't go along with the plan. Who said that these mechanisms like assigning foreign aid that the U.S. was giving Israel as collateral in case there wasn't an attack, that didn't pass legal muster. It left a considerable bitterness among Bechtel and officials who worked hard on this pipeline project for 2 years, mm-hmm. while at the same time, Saddam was unleashing thousands of chemical bombs on Iranians.
And so how does that, in your opinion, factor into what we're seeing taking place now, where many have said this war with Saddam Hussein, although the Bush administration says it is to disarm Saddam Hussein, and in fact it has admitted it wants to implement regime change, others have said that it's really about the oil that is embedded in the Iraq soil.
Yeah. I mean, the United States military would not be in the Persian Gulf, would not have this interest in the Persian Gulf were it not for oil.
But how does that relate directly to this whole Bechtel pipeline scheme?
Right, the Bechtel pipeline scheme was an effort to counter the Iranian threat, and so it was wrapped up in the geopolitics of the time. I mean, the whole history of U.S. and British intervention in the Middle East, beginning in 1911, is driven by oil. In 1911, British interests set up the Iraq Petroleum Company. And well, today, we see what Rumsfeld and company did in the 80s, and we see what they wrote in the 1990s when they wrote to President Clinton urging military action. When they were creating the blueprints for this strategy that we're seeing played out in brutal detail today, they repeatedly base their case upon the Iraqi threat to global energy security. Only when they took power in the Bush-Cheney administration did they drop long-standing language in national security policy saying that military force will be deployed when there are threats to energy security in the Persian Gulf. As recently as last August, when Dick Cheney really rattled the war fever in a speech to the Veterans for Foreign Wars, that's the last time the Bush-Cheney administration mentioned oil in Iraq in the same breath. He cited the specter, he invoked the specter of Saddam Hussein holding weapons of mass destruction and oil as ransom against the Western world. Since then, the Bush-Cheney administration has steadfastly, they rebutted and refuted any sort of argument that this has anything to do with oil, and now they don't even mention the word oil. They avoid the word oil at all costs in terms of discussing U.S. Intervention there.
Jim Vallette is the author of Crude Vision, How Oil Interests Obscured U.S. Government Focus on Chemical Weapons Use by Saddam Hussein. Vallette is research director for the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network, a project of the Institute for Policy Studies. The Reverend William Sloan Coffin, one of the most respected leaders of the anti-Vietnam War movement, served as a chaplain at Yale University from 1957 to 1975. He is best known for his outspoken support of young men resisting the draft. In 1968, he and four other men over draft age were convicted of conspiracy to aid and abet draft resistors. They faced 5 years in prison, but the charges were dropped on appeal. Coffin spoke recently at Yale in conjunction with the opening of an exhibit at the school's library called Give Peace a Chance. It's a look at anti-war activism from World War I through the 1980s, based in part on Coffin's papers that he donated to the university. In the following excerpt from his speech, Coffin elaborates on the similarities between America's wars against anti-communism and anti-terrorism.
At my age, it's a pleasure to be anywhere. But a special one to be here in this library, where, as opposed to a much better known Yale graduate, I spent lots of time as an undergraduate. I'm sorry that my words don't skip like stone on water, but I trust we can understand each other. War is humanity's most chronic and incurable disease. Plato said, only the dead have known an end to war. And now, as the new century begins, we see anti-terrorism replacing anti-communism, which means that the same mistakes are being repeated over and over again. Except, in our day, the whole situation is much more open-ended and interminable. The proposed war against Iraq is as ill-conceived as was the one we lost in Southeast Asia. We shall become the authors of terrorism, of which we are also the target. To make American lives increasingly vulnerable is about as far removed from the national interest as I can see. And who can doubt but the chief casualties of a war against Iraq will be the carnage, blood, fortunes of the 22 million citizens of Iraq who for years have been the first victims of this cruel dictator. If the conflict continues to grow nearer, there will be calls for Americans to unify around the president. But what is the virtue of unity if it's unity in folly and cruelty? In a democracy, dissent is not disloyal. It's subservience to a bad policy that is deeply unpatriotic. The time has come to heed, not scorn, the UN. To beware the messianic pretensions that bedevil superpowers. We all know that peace doesn't come in on the wheels of inevitability. We can't just wish for peace. We have to will it, fight for it, suffer for it, demand it of our governments as if peace were God's most cherished hope for humanity. Let me go on to point out the parallels between anti-communism and anti-terrorism, the pending war against Iraq, and the Vietnam War of the 60s. We saw then, we see now, the cult of presidential infallibility. We saw then, we see now, the cancerous growth of official secrecy, lying by the executive branch to other branches of government and to the public. Outstanding in the 60s was a colossal lie that was represented by so-called Tonkin Resolution in August, I think it was 7th, 1964. President Johnson said to the Congress and to the American people that the USS Maddox, a destroyer, was doing something outside of territorial limits of North Vietnam, and that the North Vietnamese had attacked the Maddox. Now we know that John McComb, head of the CIA, said the North Vietnamese were reacting in defense. But none of that came out then. And the vote in the House was 416 to zip. In the Senate, as many of you know, the vote was 88 to 2. Gruning of Alaska and Morse, that bulldog from Oregon. And the result, after the vote was taken, given to Johnson, and now giving to Bush the authority they needed, the result was congressional courage, is to say the least, in short supply. Let's go on with a couple of these parallels. It grates me more than almost anything to listen to the pious, patriotic platitudes. Bush has the gall to say what we're doing is in the greatest moral tradition of the United States. LBJ, President Johnson, kept talking about the cause of freedom. The message to third world countries in those days, and I'm afraid it still is, it goes like this. If the status quo is tolerable for us, never mind how intolerable it may be for you. And if it's intolerable for us, never mind how tolerable it may be for you. Because we attacked a lot of countries where the situation is quite tolerable. For instance, the duly elected Mossadegh government in Iran in 53, the duly elected Arbenz government in Guatemala in 54.
The Reverend William Sloan Coffin, speaking at Yale University. Thanks to Melinda Tuhus for producing that piece. Finally tonight, children's author Hans Christian Andersen was probably not far off when he said, "Where words fail, music speaks." In the state of Maine, a community is coming together to sing through fear and make music a form of political protest during this time of war. From Portland, Karen DeAndre has this report.
Shalom, shalom. Shalom, shalom. Peace, shalom, shalom. In Baghdad. Peace, shalom, shalom. In Basra.
When we hear of an anti-war demonstration today, we tend to think of a loud, raucous group banging drums and yelling chants. Some critics of the movement have noted a lack of anti-war and peace music similar to that used during the Vietnam War and the Civil Rights Movement. Maine Voices for Peace, a newly formed organization in Portland, Maine, is bringing back the old tradition of using music to spread the message of peace and song to louden the voices of protest.
My name's Phil Hose. I'm a co-organizer of this event, which is a community sing against the war, the proposed invasion of Iraq. Raising voices in song is, I just think it's one of the most powerful things that you can do, either individually or especially as a group. I mean, what's the first thing a mother does with an infant, you know? She sings to it. And I think, you know, the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, many of the real political struggles that have marked this country have been characterized by song. We've heard a lot of stories, news stories, saying that this is not a singing protest movement, that it seems vigorous but kind of silent. And we're here to show that there are plenty of loud, good singers and plenty of songs to sing, and that it's still an effective thing to do.
Twelfth day of invasion, my leader said to me, they plan to use the bomb. Not fairly elected, invaded other countries, come to trade Al-Qaeda, execute. persecute their people. They just can't be trusted. All they want is oil.
Demand regime change now.
Didn't sign the treaty, won't allow inspections, weapons of destruction.
They're the most dangerous nation in the world.
Hosts and co-organizer Priscilla Drayman, a United Methodist minister, got together about a month ago. They wanted to use the power of music as they had seen it work in the past to advance the movement down a more creative path.
We feel that that singing voices have been lacking in terms of people lifting their voices against the war and also for peace, and that there's a rich heritage of protest music and songs for peace that needs to be heard again, as well as new songs that will also speak to this issue.
Drayman says the power of music brings the community together. The music helps us to deal with adversity and gives us hope.
When we sing together, we become unified. Often when we're afraid to speak the words ourselves, the songs that others have written find a place in our soul that speaks truth for us, and that when we do that with others, there is a sense of hope, a sense of, again, of unity, and a sense that we're not alone in our feelings.
I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside, down by the riverside, way down by the riverside. I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside. I'm gonna study war no more. I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more.
When the group met for this first community sing, it attracted a diverse gathering of almost 70 people. They don't know what might be in the future for them or for the world, but they hope to meet again soon to further the peace process through song.
Let us sing this song for the turning of the world, that we may live.
In Portland, Maine, this is Karen DeAndre for Pacifica Peace Watch.
Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. And our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Reem Kathuta, Benta Berkland, Ryan Kilpatrick, and Keith Chalgion. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit Pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.
We will